And I saw on the record you were sometimes referred to as Mr. Kassab and sometimes as Mr. Alaric Lorenzo. Which do you prefer?
Mr. Kassab, Your Honor.
Mr. Kassab. All right. And Mr. Kassab, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, Alaric Lorenzo Kassab for the appellant, Larry Jones. Your Honors, in August of 2024, when this case first went to trial, in a unanimous jury verdict, we won. I would ask the court, at its convenience.
Help me to understand exactly what went wrong with the jury instructions, because I found it somewhat confusing. Did the court just simply fail to provide instructions on damages in both in writing and orally? Is that what happened?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the court did provide instructions on damages, I think, in writing, but it did not give a full instruction as to whether or not they could consider past pain and suffering, future pain and suffering.
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand is, was there an instruction that should have been used that just was not either given to the jury in writing or said orally, or was there a situation in which they got it in writing but it wasn't said orally or vice versa? I found it to be unclear.
I believe that if there was any instructions on damages, it would have been only in writing. But the verdict
form... So did the jury actually get instructions on damages in writing and the physical copy they had?
Your Honor, that I cannot say for sure. But what I know is that I recall that in the verdict form, the judge just asked that they fill in damages they were awarded.
Did the judge's oral instructions even include the elements of the claims, of the cause of action?
Okay. His oral instructions did not, but the written instructions did, and...
And everyone sat there, and the judge gives this horrifically incomplete set of instructions, and everyone just sat there, and no one said anything? And no one stood up and said, Your Honor, you've missed, like, the main instructions in the case.
As you would see, if you look at your convenience at the excerpts of record 9ER244... I constantly would try to stand and tell the judge that, hey, Your Honor, we need you to do this and do that. And he would tell me to sit down. He acknowledges in 9ER244 that this happened so many times. And he would say, you know, I told you to sit down, but you figured out a way to tell me things.
Including specifically as to the punitive damages piece of this?
Punitive damages, when we started trial, we did not know that they were even bifurcated. Then... Before the case is submitted, the judge makes us understand that they will not determine punitive damages now. So as soon as the verdict was announced, I'm expecting the judge, first of all, we still had the Monell claim that was pending, and we had the punitive damages issue. So I'm expecting him to go ahead and ask them to go back and consider punitive damages. He reads the verdict and dismisses them.
But at that point, why were you not jumping out of your chair saying, don't let the jurors out of this courtroom?
Judge Wilson... is known, Your Honor. You would look at 9ER244 and see he would constantly tell you to sit down. So as soon as the jury was leaving, I stood up. Because after he dismissed them, he started talking. I said, Your Honor, we have punitive damages. The jury had just retired into the deliberation room. The clerk of court went in there, and he just went in and came back and said, they left. We're on the 10th floor. If they wanted them back, they could have gotten them back. They had not even left. It wasn't even 2 minutes since they had been dismissed. So that was what happened. Anyways, Your Honor, we won the first trial. My closing arguments to the jury, docket number 187, the transcript were only ready after we had filed.
What happened with the transcript? Did you try and get an expedited transcript of the first trial so that you would have the record to be able to cross people on your testimony?
And as you can even see, my closing arguments were only ready after this appeal was filed. My understanding is that the court reporter was fired. I had to be calling her personally, tracking her house, trying to get her number to call her and beg her to do what she had to do.
Is any of this in the record? The part about you trying to track these things down by going to her house and her being fired, is that anywhere in the record?
No, but as you would see, because each time that this transcript, when we placed the orders, we would file it.
Did you ask the court to delay the trial until the transcript could be prepared?
When the court ordered a new trial, the court gave us 7 days, I think a week, to appear for the second trial. Given my experience with Judge Wilson. And I think if counsel, who was trial counsel for the defendants in the first trial, if she was here, I think that she would agree that this is one of the most difficult courtrooms you can ever be in. Judge Wilson's court is known as the Rocket Docket. It's not easy being there. He tells you to sit down. Even when you stand to tell him that, hey, there's a mistake, there's this, he tells you to sit down. It's a war room. You really can't do anything. Judge Wilson is above 80. So, God bless him.
So the second trial was held a week after the first one?
No, a month after the first one, but a week after the court granted a motion for reconsideration. Okay. On 9/11. 2024. Nothing good comes out of 9/11, Your Honors. And that was the day when the judge decided, after agreeing that we're going to have a second, you know, a trial only on damages. Because what happened was, after the verdict was read, you know, I told him about the punitive damages. They said the jury had left. He said we would return on Monday because it was a Friday for the continuation.
The jury hadn't determined eligibility for punitive damages. And that issue was just inextricably intertwined with the underlying issues. And so how do you, I think that was what the court was troubled by. How do you sever those? It isn't just calculating the extent of the injury.
Yes, Your Honor. And so, like you have seen in the briefs, Marocain, the case of Marocain, which is what decided when they filed their motion for reconsideration, Your Honor. The question that we must ask ourselves is that what is the harm that Marocain and gasoline products and United Airlines aim to cure? The harm is that when punitive damages are sought, the degree of culpability of the defendant has to be established. In this case, an Eighth Amendment violation case, where we argued maliciousness, we argued intentionality, we argued purposefulness. It is in docket number 187, pages 13 and 16. The jury found in our favor, which means that we have already established the degree of culpability of defendant of the deputy. There is no reason then to come back and say it is intertwined and we cannot have a second separate trial on punitive damages. It has been done. This circuit has reversed cases and asked that punitive damages alone be considered. It is not Greek mythology. Yes, I understand the concern for Marocain, but Marocain is factually distinguishable. Marocain was a Fourth Amendment excessive force case. In the Fourth Amendment excessive force cases, Your Honor, the facts have to, you look at it from an objective point of view. Subjective intent does not come to play. In an excessive force case based on the Eighth Amendment, you look at subjectiveness, you look at intentionality, maliciousness, sadistic behavior. In this case, I am asking that this court distinguish Marocain from all cases that have to do with the Eighth Amendment, because the Eighth Amendment encapsulates the elements required for punitive damages. We had already established that the actions of...
Do you think, even though it wasn't framed as eligibility for punitive damages, the jury's finding essentially established that punitive damages were eligible and that therefore it was just damages and amount of punitives?
Yes, Your Honor, because again, like I said, we argued, even if the judge did not put it in his oral instructions, defendants did not object to that, it was in the written instructions. And in my closing arguments, I went through the elements, pages 13 and 16 of docket number 187, which is my closing argument. I argued maliciousness, intentionality, purposefulness. And the jury found in our favor. The jury watched the video three times. They requested to watch the video three times, the first jury. Now, in the second trial, what happened? My star witness, which is one of the inmates, Mr. Turner, who watched everything happen as it unfolded, he heard everything. He had testified during the first trial.
So, I do want to hear a little bit about Turner, but I'm trying to figure out what you wanted that second trial to look like. What would have looked like? If you had had a trial that was only limited to punitives, would you still have to put all the witnesses on so that they had understood what happened? Would you have to get Mr. Turner there so he tells what Deputy Inigo said?
No. The second trial was just meant for the jury to determine the amount of punitive damages, if any.
Right, but how would it would be a new jury, right? It wouldn't be the old jury.
Correct.
Okay, but if you have a new jury, how do they get the context for punitive damages? Even if a judge comes in and says, damages have already been set in a prior trial, so I need you to decide the punitives. How do you decide the punitives if you don't put all the witnesses on and they don't get to view the video?
No, Your Honor, of course we would have had to show them the video that this is the incident that happened, and the first jury has found that this was done maliciously.
And, do you put Jones on?
I would have called
Put Gay on?
No, I don't need Gay anymore, Your Honor, because we've already established liability. Now we are just going in for the amount. And the jury in its discretion could have said, well, yes, it was malicious, but we're not going to punish him. It could be $1. It could be $2. Then we also had the damages issue because...
I think Judge Bybee's point is that even if maliciousness is established for purposes of eligibility for punitives, in assessing the reprehensibility of the conduct, you need some texture to understanding the circumstances of the action and whether or not the behavior of the officer really warrants that. And so you're basically going to put on a lot of the same case.
Well, Your Honor, then in that case, then no case would ever go on a second trial only on punitive damages, because that has happened in the circuit. Many cases have gone for a second trial only on punitives. Of course, you have to give them some context, but we're saying that, Your Honor, the Seventh Amendment says that when a verdict has been reached pursuant to trial that was done constitutionally, it should not be disturbed. This verdict was reached pursuant to proper arguments that we made and the evidence. And in fact, Your Honors, I would call the court's attention to Scott versus Harris. The Supreme Court of the United States said that if the version of facts provided by one party differ from the record, from the video.
What do you think that the officer said that is blatantly contradicted by the video in Scott v. Harris sense?
Almost everything, Your Honor. First of all, he said he had to kick that door because the door is heavy. Three times that door was opened and closed without any issues. When he took the plaintiff out of the shower to his cell, he closed that door without kicking it. He closed the trace lock because he was angry. They called them because my client had fallen in the shower. He was mad at him. He closed the trace lock. When they asked him during the first trial, why did you close the trace lock? He said, my client said he told him that you're not going to use the phone because you're acting like an asshole. So he closed the trace lock so my client could not send his hand to take the trace lock. He also lied that he was scared of Mr. Gay, but you can see in the video, he opened the door and turned his back. Mr. Gay was right there, open. The cell was open. So many lies, Your Honor. If you look at the video, there was no reason to kick that door.
Yeah, okay. Deputy Inigo testifies that he saw blood. But I'm trying to figure out where he saw the blood. What blood did he see? He said he saw his bloody hand.
Yes,
but he saw his bloody hand where? The food access slot was closed. Was there a window? Did he see the hand in the window?
There is a window, but I also think that what he meant was that when he kicked the door shut, because he kicked it shut on the finger,
right?
So it's right there, and the blood is gushing out. You know what I'm saying? So I'm sure that is what he meant.
But
by
when I looked at the video, I don't remember seeing blood running down the post of the door frame.
Your Honor, it's not going to be blood like gushing out of some nerve or something. This is blood from the finger, probably a stain on the door. But he testified that he saw it.
I know he did. I just couldn't figure out where he saw it.
I'm pretty sure it was when the incident happened. And then, Your Honor, if I can briefly talk.
You were going to mention about Turner. Can you go
yes,
back to that?
Turner issue? Stated that the deputy told him that this is because Turner told him you're going to get in trouble for what
but
you did.
But you tried to get Turner for the second trial.
The prison, they wouldn't let. They told me they would not produce him. They told me if they did, they would put it only on only the phone on. That was what they did during the first trial. They didn't want to turn on the video. I had to tell, and the court dismissed the witnesses. I said, Your Honor, no, they are playing a game. They can turn on the video. They turned it on the first time. They were able to testify. They knew by the time we got to the second trial, everything that Turner said. I called the prison. I submitted the order for them to produce Turner. They told me they would categorically not produce him. And if they did, it would be by phone only. When they brought in...
Why didn't you accept... I mean, you still had your objection. Why didn't you accept the phone only?
Oh, no. Well, with Turner, they said that, but then they ended up not doing it.
Not even doing that.
Yes. But with Gay, they brought him in. You know, and then they turned on the phone, they wouldn't turn on the video. The judge dismissed him again. I said, Your Honor, this is what they did in the first trial. I called the prison after the break and told them that somebody was doing something that's preventing this man from testifying. I need them to turn on the video. There was someone I spoke to. He said, don't worry, I'm going to work on this. And then they brought him back, and I told the judge, then they turned on the video. That was how Gay was able to testify. Your Honor, the second trial permitted them to close all the holes that we had punched in their story. They went in and changed everything. I fought so, you know, the excessive force claim is hardly, people hardly win that claim. If we won it, and these people, the defendants had a second chance, they made sure that they left no stone unturned. That first verdict should not be disturbed, Your Honor.
You've almost used your time, but we've asked you a lot of questions, so I'm going to give you 3 minutes for rebuttal that I think we should hear from other side at this point. All right. So we will hear next from Mr. Stepanian.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Karin Stepanian, and I represent the Appalese. There are a few things that I would like to address.
Can we begin by clarifying? I want to make sure we're on the same page, understanding what happened with the jury instructions and what exactly the error was. I frankly had a hard time figuring this out, in part because in the critical pages of your brief, you cite pages that don't exist in the excerpts. You have 3 ER 264, which there's no such page number in volume 3. It's in volume 2, and it doesn't correspond to the page. So I kind of got a bit lost in trying to follow your brief. You might, if I'm right that those are wrong, you should file a corrected brief that corrects the record cites so that they don't send us down rabbit holes.
I apologize, Judge Collins, for that, and I actually did review last night, and I realized that there was a discrepancy in terms of record citations, and I do have a correct record cites right here that I'm able to provide to the court. And I think the discussion that police plan to cite was the following the dismissal of the jury on Monday, August 19th, where the district court indicated that the instruction concerning the punitive damages might have been given to the jury in writing, so were the compensatory damages. But the
They may have actually gotten both the compensatory and the punitive damage instructions in writing, but they were never said orally.
They were never said.
What about the elements of the cause of action? Were those said orally?
I don't think the elements of the causes of action were said orally either.
Were they given in writing to the jury?
I believe they were given in writing to the
And everyone just sat there. This is the looking at the oral transcript, the worst set of jury instructions I've ever seen. And no one stood up and said, Your Honor, you've missed half of it. You don't give the oral instruction with the elements of the cause of action?
Your Honor, correct. There were no directing the district court's attention to that. However, counsel for appellants did argue that the standard for the finding of excessive force was malicious and sadistic, and the jury nevertheless returned the verdict for appellant.
So on the punitive damages written instructions, are you saying that those were provided to the jury? I thought the judge had in mind bifurcating.
Your Honor, I'm not sure if I can answer that question correctly. The point is the alleged mistake in the first trial that was the jury never left after the verdict was rendered for appellant to decide issue of punitive damages. They were discharged. So now whether the instructions were given or not, jury still had to be called back and let known that they are to decide the issue of punitive damages. And the district court tried to get the jury back. Now, I don't know whether 1 minute, 2 minutes was sufficient for the jury to exit the courthouse on Friday afternoon, but the jury deputy clerk came back, said to the district court that the jury was gone. So now the question was how the district court was supposed to remedy that issue. Ordering a new trial, full new trial, was the correct remedy. And we do not argue that the Rule 59A1A allows a trial of fewer than all issues. However, that rule is subject to Seventh Amendment constraints. And the United States Supreme Court in gasoline products indicated that where the issues are the issue to be tried, if the issue to be tried is distinct and separable, so trying it separately can be done without injustice, then it should be tried. But where the issues of exemplary punitive damages and liability is so intertwined that trying them separately would cause confusion and uncertainty, then the retrial should be had on all issues. And that's what district court ordered. So if there are any issues with the first trial, the second trial remedied those by the district court ordering the second trial remedied those mistakes.
So why wasn't Turner present at the second trial when he had been they you know issued the right subpoena or gone through the right process to try and get him there? Why wasn't he there?
Your Honor, appellees don't know why the Turner wasn't able to. There were some logistical issues. Appellant's counsel was going back and forth out of the courtroom and back on the phone with the prison system. But neither the county system nor the district court had anything to do with whatever issues were with Mr. Turner. But even if Turner
we're just supposed to look the other way? I mean, that benefits the county, that county employees are not complying with the court process to get this witness's testimony that's been demanded for a civil trial.
Judge Collins, I don't believe that Mr. Turner was in a county custody. I think he was in a state prison, and I don't believe there's nothing in the record that
okay.
the county...
So he was in state, not in county custody.
We don't have anything...
We don't, nothing in the
that's
record.
That's my understanding. Nothing in the record to indicate that the okay. county had custody of Mr. Turner. But even if Mr. Turner's testimony as appellant argues were not presented. That testimony consisted of one statement that happened after the incident. We don't know.
Even is not trivial, particularly to punitives.
It is not trivial, but it's vague, Judge Collins. We don't know what's meant. I've done worse things. Was I late?
Well, that's for the jury to figure out. And if Mr. Inigo wishes to come back, the county wants to put Mr. Inigo back on there and explain his statement, you're free to do so. But this is a pretty explosive statement.
And appellant's counsel asked that question of Mr. Inigo. He asked Deputy Inigo, have you told to Mr. Turner that you've done the worst things in the county? He denied making the statement.
Well, it's hard to see how that helps, though. I mean, there was another witness who would say otherwise.
Well, that is why if appellant counsel wanted to impeach Deputy Inigo, that's where the transcript should have been produced and appellant could properly lay a foundation.
I mean, are they to be faulted for the court reporter's lack of diligence that, you know, the court basically was not going to allow any cross on the prior testimony from the first trial? Absent the transcript, they had no ability to get the transcript. The reporter didn't produce it. And so this entire line of inquiry, everything that was said at the first trial, is off limits.
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to reflect appellant's counsel's efforts to expedite the transcript. So we don't know really what was transpiring, what communication was between appellant's counsel and the court reporter. And to address a counsel's earlier point that they were given 7 days to have a trial, I believe the district court asked the parties within 7 days meet and confer and come with a date that will both work for them. And I believe counsel indicated to the trial counsel for the appellees that he had planned vacation, so he wanted to have it, I believe, earlier.
Is that in the record, any of this?
I don't believe that's in the record, but that's if that's incorrect.
Why did the district court exclude things from the second trial that were permitted in the first trial?
Your Honor, first of all, the exclusion was very probative value of that evidence was very minimal, and the risk of prejudice was much higher. What the two pieces of evidence?
Did the district court say that?
Yes, the district court.
And so was it reversing itself? Was it finding that it had made an obvious error in the first trial?
Your Honor, those decisions reviewed for abuse of discretion, and then the district court does not abuse
discretion. But an abuse of discretion can be for violating principles or principles of law. And one of the principles is that generally evidentiary decisions made in a first trial, that evidence will still be admitted in a second trial unless there has been a change in the law or some other obvious error.
I understand that, Judge Bybee, and I believe appellant's counsel cites docket 89. I don't think that's in the record, but appellant's counsel cites docket 89 to show that those two pieces of evidence were admitted. However, looking at that docket, the marks concerning those two exhibits are at the column that says identified. There is no mark that those exhibits were admitted and were presented to the jury.
What was the nature of the pretrial discovery here? Were there depositions taken of any of these witnesses?
I may not have sufficient information to respond to that, Judge Bress, but I know for a fact that there was no deposition of Deputy Unigo taken, and I am unclear whether there are any other depositions were
Okay. Would you turn to the judge's judgment, the summary judgment ruling on the deliberate indifference?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a high standard. It's more than negligence. It's more than gross negligence. Appellant had to show that there was actual awareness of serious risk, conscious disregard of that risk. Deputy Unigo provided
How is it not a conscious disregard? I mean, he knew that he was injured right away because he goes and gets medical attention, but he walks pretty leisurely down that hallway in what was really an emergency situation. Why isn't that on its face deliberate indifference?
Your Honor, Deputy Unigo only learned of injury after the appellant smacked his finger at the over the window of the cell. Or at that point, he only realized that that was the point of the injury. And when
he is screaming, and Gay is testifying that he is screaming, "You took off my finger! My finger's trapped in the door." And Unigo says he saw the blood. I don't know where he saw the blood because I didn't see the blood on the video. And he doesn't even turn his head. And he just deals with Gay, and then he walks off. 5 minutes later, he comes back with medical assistance, and we've got a fingertip stuck in the door.
Your Honor, as soon as he shut the door, he perhaps saw the blood. He secured the inmate Gay, who was loose in the hallway. Right after securing him, he walked toward the whether he should have run to the dispatcher's booth and then telephoned for help, that's not an inquiry.
Why isn't that a jury question as to whether it's deliberate indifference to saunter off in the direction of, you know, medical help? He doesn't have his radio with him. He doesn't have very far to go because this is not a very big area. But it's 5 minutes before he comes back.
Your Honor, the damage was already done to appellant.
How does he know that? He's not a doctor. He didn't turn around and look. He didn't try to reopen the door in case the whole hand was simply stuck and we had broken fingers as opposed to a fingertip that's been severed. He hasn't made any inquiry at all.
Not to mention the indifference to the agony during the time period.
And that's what Deputy Inigo explained, that he was not trained in providing medical
assistance. Why are we supposed to take his explanations? Why isn't that a jury question? The district court said that no reasonable jury could find that he had been indifferent. And as I look at that video, it certainly seems to me that a jury could decide that he had been indifferent.
In addressing serious medical need to appellant, and the record shows and declaration of Deputy Inigo states that he was whatever the extent of the injury was, he didn't feel like he could provide the necessary medical help. So he went and brought.
He might have opened the door.
But that's, again, reasonable minds here would have to, it is not a clear one-way street to show that by opening the door, appellant's injury would have been remedied.
But you don't know that, and I don't know that, and I don't think that Inigo knows that, and I'm not sure anybody else knows that.
But the circumstances of the events that were unfolding had to be taken into account before we could decide whether a reasonable jury could disagree.
The district court pre-permitted a trial on this issue. That's the whole problem. I mean, you know, knowing that someone has been injured, that the door is closed on the hand, and then walking away leisurely and leaving him in that condition for 5 minutes, why isn't that a jury question on deliberate indifference? I mean, I understand your arguments. You can make these arguments to a jury, but I don't see why this was withheld from the jury.
And, Your Honor, again, we will, our position is that given the circumstances that Deputy Nigo was not prepared to render first aid help to appellant and the escalated tension that escalated prior to that, just considering all those circumstances, the one solution that was appropriate for Deputy Nigo to do is just to go and bring medical assistance, which actually arrived within less than 2 minutes.
What does the record say about how long Mr. Jones's finger was caught in the door?
It was caught from the door, and the video is probably the best evidence from the time the door was shut until the medical assistance.
How long was it actually stuck in the door, the finger? Does the record show that?
The record would show from the moment the door closes and the moment the door opens when medical assistance and other deputies.
But it wasn't caught in there the whole time, right?
It was caught there in the whole time.
The hand was stuck in the door the entire time?
Not the hand, but the fingertip was stuck there.
No, but I'm talking the fingertip attached to the hand. At what point, how long was the fingertip in the door before he pulled it out? Does the record show?
I think, Your Honor, it's immediately because the Deputy Nigo testified that that's how he saw blood, John smacking his severed finger over the window. So at that point, while Deputy Nigo was still there, the finger, the tip of the finger was already severed.
And so the time from when the hand is smashed in the door, is slammed in the door, until the finger is removed is 5 minutes.
No, Your Honor. It's probably a matter of seconds.
No, until the door is reopened, yes, and the finger is removed is 5 minutes, right? That's the district court's finding.
That's in
the summary judgment. He says that it took Inigo approximately 5 minutes to return with medical assistance.
Correct. So that's the time frame when the door was open and the tip of the finger was there. However, the severance of the finger, the tip of the finger, occurred almost immediately when appellant smacked his finger over the window. I see my time is. Oh, I still have few.
No,
minutes.
You're actually over. But Your Honor, I'll let you wrap up.
Yes, we
seconds.
Just most of the decisions that was made by the district court are reviewed for abuse of discretion, and there is sufficient evidence for the jury findings in the second trial. So we would appellees respectfully request the this court affirm the judgment in full.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal. Can you address Judge Bress's question? What does the record evidence on the summary judgment record show, or in the trial record, on when he removed his hand and basically acquiesced in the severing of the tip of the finger?
Your Honor, I know that he removed his hand maybe within like 2 minutes of the deputy walking away, because I think at that point they were trying to have the deputy come back and reopen the door. He did not, which would have stopped the plaintiff from trying to yank his hand off because he was in so much pain.
I understood counsel was saying like he did it immediately. You don't think that's correct?
No, Your Honor. Again, you know, counsel was counsel for the second trial. The counsel was there for the first trial. It's not here. That's why counsel sometimes.
Okay, but so I'm still trying to figure out the chronology here. So if he slams the finger in the door, yes, how does Inigo see blood?
Your Honor, that was his testimony. I believe that it was when he slammed the finger, because by slamming it, there must have been a little bit of blood that might have oozed out.
Okay, but again, I don't remember seeing any blood on the post in the video. Counsel for the county suggests that he really pulls the finger quickly, that severs it, and that he's pounding on the window, and that's how Inigo sees the blood is on the window when he's evidently pounding his hand on the window.
That is possible, Your Honor.
Well, that would be then almost immediately.
That is possible.
I mean, there's just a lot of uncertainty about that question.
Yes, and that's why I believe that a deliberate indifference claim should never have been resolved on summary judgment, because like we stated in our briefs, the case of Heflin versus Stewart is a Sixth Circuit case where deputies arrived at an inmate cell and found him hanging and did not pull him down. And the court found that they were deliberately indifferent by not bringing him down. An inmate who had committed suicide, even though they thought he was already dead, the court said they should have at least attempted to bring him down. Deputy Inigo walks away after slamming the door on plaintiff's finger. I mean, even children know that if you're playing with your brother in your dad's car and you slam the door, you have to reopen it. He did not do that. Your Honor,
Let me just ask you on this. Is the deliberate indifference not reopening the door immediately or soon, or is a deliberate indifference the more casual way in which he walked away, or both?
All of them. Walking away, not reopening the door, not returning. In his transcript, he did not return with the other people. He did not even return to bother and see, oh, how did this happen?
Let's put aside how long the finger was actually stuck in the door, intact, attached to the hand, because that is, I don't know the answer to that and how long it was in there, but the walking away, if he had expressed great surprise and exclamation, Inigo, and said, oh my goodness, you know, I can see you're in pain. I will rush, you know, I will walk faster to get you medical attention. How would this be any different? I mean, because what would have happened would have been the same.
We believe that he should have reopened the door because that is what
I understand that, but I'm asking about the walking away.
Yes.
And his demeanor. I mean,
think that was too casual for someone that was facing such an emergency.
But what difference would it have made? I mean, if he had exclaimed and said, oh, my goodness, I will get you help, and then had walked slightly faster away, what would have really changed here?
That would have shown that he was not being deliberately indifferent. Well, I would have expected him to run, actually, not walk, Your Honor.
But he did go and summon medical attention, and it arrived within several minutes.
Yes, Your Honor, but in certain emergencies, even in real life, when every second counts, the police are only minutes away. Minutes could be...
How far did he have to go and get help? The testimony was, what, 20 to 30 feet?
No, he was not very clear about that because I asked him, who did you call?
Yeah, but down the hall, I think the testimony from Gay was that there were only seven cells on this hallway.
Yes.
And I thought the testimony from a couple of them, including Inigo, was that he was 20 to 30 feet from his station where he'd left his radio. And that having the radio wouldn't have accelerated anything here.
I believe that was his testimony, Your Honor, but I think that five...
Do we know where the medical help had to come from?
It had to come from the nursing, from the, I think they have a medical center somewhere.
Okay, but someplace else.
Yes, somewhere else. Your Honors,
over your time, but I'll give you 30 seconds to wrap up.
Okay, Your Honors. Your Honors, I just want to say that we had the first verdict was for the plaintiff. The sheriff's department, when they conducted the investigation, they granted the grievance. They rarely do so. Granting a grievance means...
You said that docket entry shows that was actually only identified in the first trial, not admitted. Is that wrong?
It was admitted. Those were admitted. It's just that in the judges in the lower court, there was a lot of just things thrown around because the judge sometimes was a little bit difficult. But like I said, if you look at the docket that I cited, I think 9ER244.
So it was only the grievance was only excluded in the second trial.
Yes, the grievance
and the judge's claim. The explanation was
he said not relevant.
There's no specificity to it, nothing. So it's too prejudicial.
Nothing. The grievance and the results of the grievance, which would have shown that the grievance was granted.
Now, the result of the grievance, I thought, said something about internal investigation authorized. Do you know whether there was further investigation as a result of that?
No, it said investigation was commenced and then administrative action was taken. And then on the left side, I think it says that the deputy's action, he did not follow their guidelines or something like that to that effect.
So the judge said, well, this is sort of vague. Was there other record evidence that could have been brought forward on what this all meant?
No, he didn't say it was vague. He just said, why are you bringing it in? It's not relevant.
But what I was wondering about is when on the portion of the form that says approved disposition, and there's a bunch of pre-printed boxes, and the one that's checked says internal affairs investigation initiated. So that's the disposition, which suggests there'll be a further internal affairs investigation after this grievance resolution. Do you know whether that happened and was yes. anything about that introduced?
Yes, in an exhibit to the complaint that was filed, we actually have the result where it says it was granted. The exhibit to the complaint that is on, I don't have the citation here, Your Honor, but it's there in our excerpts. The complaint itself, there is an exhibit to it which actually has the granting of the grievance. It narrates the facts and then it grants it.
Okay. All right. Unless further questions? All right. Thank you, counsel. The case just argued will be submitted, and this court for this session today stands adjourned.
All right. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit.